Leonard Goldenson, the founder and chairman of ABC Incorporated, also had a child, a daughter, with cerebral palsy. I knew him only slightly, but he and Jack Houseman, because of their mutual concern, were close friends and had co-founded the United Cerebral Palsy Association. Houseman was on the board of ABC. The two of them must have talked because one day, out of the blue, Houseman called and asked if he could see me. It was during that meeting that he inquired if I had any interest in leaving NBC and coming to ABC, which was considering doing its own morning show. He told me that ABC would be willing to pay me a great deal of money. I gave my answer immediately. "Thank you, but no," I said. Why would I want to leave a successful morning program where I was happy for an unproven morning program at a rival network? So Good Morning America did not debut with me, but instead with its co-hosts, note the co, David Hartman and Nancy Dussault. She would be replaced a year later by Joan London. Though GMA's co-hosts were a very attractive team, they never came close to beating us. I didn't give ABC another thought. I was in my happiest place in years. The Today Show was bringing in $10 million a year in profits, making it NBC's most lucrative daytime program and the envy of other networks. Furthermore, my contribution was being recognized. In 1975, the International Radio and Television Society named me Broadcaster of the Year, a very prestigious honor. This award meant a good deal to me because it came from my colleagues in the television industry. I also won the Emmy for the best host or hostess of a talk, service, or variety series. This award, too, meant a great deal to me. But there was a little hitch. Emmy nominations are made by the individual programs, and Stuart Schulberg, today's producer, also entered Jim Hartz for the award. Jim might have felt insulted, Stu explained to me, if he'd entered my name alone. That smarted a bit. For all that I was the co-host, on some level, I was obviously still thought of as the woman, and not as important as the man. I wondered if Stuart would have worried about my feelings if he'd only nominated Hartz. Somehow it was acceptable to nominate the man without the woman, as had been done so many times before, but not the reverse. Both Jim and I made it through the initial vote of the Emmy committee and were on the final list of four nominees. I ended up winning the award, but because Jim and I had been put in competition with each other, I couldn't really savor the moment. "I'm sorry that my partner didn't get this award because he really deserved it," I said in my remarks, "so I accept it for both of us." That slight aside, the atmosphere on the program was more upbeat than it had been in years. Jim was an easygoing presence. Since the bicentennial was coming up, his main assignment was to broadcast from every state in the country, so he was often on the program just to do special reports. This seemed to be fine with him, and I was holding the fort in the studio, conducting the major interviews. For the first time, I was also reading the news headlines at the top of the program, a task that had, in the past, gone only to the male host. I was exercising another first as well in 1975. Besides inserting the co-host clause into my contract, Lee Stevens had added the provision that NBC would allow me to develop and host a pilot for a new program, my own special. The ratings had been so high for Prince Charles's investiture, Princess Anne's wedding, and the Shaw's Gala at Persepolis that I thought the viewers might want to see more glamour and royalty. NBC agreed, so off I went to Paris with a producer named Lucy Jarvis to pursue additional glitz for the viewers. It was a disaster. What I now know is that European royalty, unless you're talking about the Queen of England and her immediate family, doesn't really sell, because what you're getting are little-known royals. But we clung to hope back then and lined up the Duke and Duchess of Orléans, pretenders to the French throne. They were a perfectly nice couple who fell under the heading of "Who Cares?" We filmed my dinner with them at Maxime's and then went off to see the Duke's racehorses running at Longchamp. We did another segment at Versailles, which was also a giant yawn. The curator, who had been there for years, opened Marie Antoinette's private rooms for us. Marie Antoinette, as you know, was the Queen of France until her head was chopped off during the French Revolution in 1793, and I almost envied her as the curator showed us every single bauble and bijou in her apartments. It was agony. I mean, how many satin appliqué butterflies can you ooh and ah over? But we had to kowtow to him. It took days and was a royal bore. In the midst of all this, I got an emergency phone call from my mother in Florida. My father was in the hospital, about to have abdominal surgery. I flew home immediately and made sure he was all right. It seemed to be a not too serious procedure. Then, as soon as I could, I flew right back to Europe. I had to help my mother, who was frightened, while at the same time, I couldn't leave my film crew and producer in Europe in the lurch. I was exhausted. At least when I returned, we had real royalty to film. Queen Margrethe of Denmark and her husband, Prince Henrik, a former French diplomat. Her story was more interesting. She was the first woman to sit on the throne of Denmark. The royal couple had two adorable little princes, one of whom fell off a horse while we were filming and was summarily placed right back in the saddle by his parents. That was kind of nice and interesting. Less so was the tour Queen Margrethe gave us of her unprepossessing palace, but at least there weren't any satin appliqué butterflies. We came home without much. The resulting pilot program, which was supposed to morph into a series titled Barbara Walters Visits, this first visit being Royal Lovers, did not do well. NBC chose to run it at 1:30 in the afternoon, hardly prime time. Most of the viewers at that hour were women who were more apt to be putting their children down for a nap than fantasizing about being married to a prince. It got no ratings. I certainly didn't think then that doing celebrity specials of any nature was a good idea. No 2020 foresight for me. What concerned me more than the ratings flop was the news from Florida. Although my father's operation had been a success, he was quite fragile and needed help walking, dressing, and going to the bathroom. It was suggested that he have a male nurse when he went home from the hospital. But the Miami apartment was very small, two bedrooms, a living room, and a tiny kitchen. My mother shared a bedroom with my sister. A nurse sitting in my father's room or in the living room all day seemed like a very bad idea to my mother. She also worried that my father wouldn't get the care he needed. She was nervous and afraid, and that meant that my sister was nervous and afraid too. It was a very bad situation. And so my mother made a drastic decision. She had my father admitted to a well-recommended nursing home. Well-recommended though it was, with excellent care and a private 24-hour nurse for my father, it was still a nursing home. If there was any silver lining, it was that there were a few men my father could play cards with. Even so, my father, being my father, hated the indignity of it. What a comedown for Lou Walters. But I think he was too weak and depressed to fight it. As for me, I couldn't fight it either. How could I force my mother to keep my father at home, even if I provided round-the-clock nurses when she herself was elderly and agitated? My mother made a great effort to visit my father at the nursing home. At least 3 times a week she got her sister, Lena, to drive her and my sister there, and she would take my father some of his favorite foods, pickled herring or salami. But he was slowly fading away. I visited him several times and religiously called him every Saturday, but he would say very little. I'd do most of the talking, telling him what I was doing, asking him questions, and he'd say, "Yes, darling," or "No, darling." My visits were too rare and always upsetting. There wasn't a time when I saw or spoke to him that I didn't feel that I should bring him to live with me and little Jackie in New York. He adored Jackie, and maybe she could have brought him out of his depression and back to life. But to my everlasting guilt, I didn't do it. My apartment was fairly small, just 2 actual bedrooms, one of which we used as a library. We would be too crowded, I thought. Today, though, I wish I had done it. But in truth, I was too busy, with too little time as it was for my Jackie. So my father stayed in the nursing home. I know it's boring to look back and keep talking about guilt, guilt, guilt. And I know that many families face the same problem today, especially as parents live longer. But I still feel the guilt so strongly that I have to force myself to write about it. I realize how much I cared about my father and how much I admired him. I am much older now. My childhood resentments are gone. I'm able to recognize the parts of him that are in me. His love of books, his enjoyment of writing, maybe even his sense of humor. With this comes the realization that I am my father's daughter, with my mother's fears. Life went on, my family in Florida, sad and lonely, I in New York, busier than ever. I was on Today every morning, followed by Not for Women Only. I was also from time to time a substitute host for Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. It was during this period that I persuaded Hugh Downs to come out of semi-retirement and alternate weeks with me hosting Not for Women Only. That lightened my load somewhat, but I also was accepting some speaking engagements and writing the occasional magazine article. I continued to share my parents' concern that this could all be over tomorrow, so I had better do everything I could to earn money for their future and mine. Doing everything meant first and foremost getting interviews that were exclusive and important. But while I was doing my usual letter writing and phone calls, bonanza. I was assigned to go to Cuba with Senator George McGovern and a bunch of other reporters to see Fidel Castro. Change was in the air in the spring of 1975. 14 years had passed since the failure of the U.S.-funded invasion of Cuba by armed Cuban exiles to overthrow Fidel Castro, and 13 years had passed since Russian shipments of nuclear missiles to communist Cuba brought the United States and Russia to the brink of war. There was talk now in the United States of normalizing relations with communist Cuba, or at least lifting part of the economic embargo that had been in place since 1962, and still is. Senator McGovern was chairman of the Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs. He was in favor of lifting the trade embargo against Cuba on both humanitarian and diplomatic grounds. McGovern hoped to leverage the positive effects of ending the embargo to eventually help with other conflicts with Cuba, including the release of 9 Americans jailed there whom the United States considered political prisoners. McGovern was also advocating a cultural and sports exchange with Cuba, in the hope that baseball could help break down the hostility that existed between our two countries. I was just one of about 15 reporters traveling with Senator McGovern. But while we were in Cuba, for some unknown reason, Castro singled me out from the rest, and for a change, my male colleagues were happy about it. We had all been in Havana for several days, being dragged from factories to medical facilities to schools, all designed to show off the accomplishments of the communist system. But no sign of the great Fidel. We were staying in what had been one of the finest hotels in pre-communist Havana, the Nacional. Along with the formerly grand mansions that dotted the Havana harbor, the hotel was badly in need of a paint job, but it had bigger problems: no air conditioning and no toilet seats. Still, there were salsa bands playing away in the lobby, and you could always get a daiquiri, Ernest Hemingway's favorite drink, when he lived in Havana. But we were not there for the daiquiris, and we were all getting pretty disgusted when on the third day we were ushered into a convoy of cars and driven some distance to a farm we were told was owned by Fidel's eldest brother, Ramon. We were lying around on the grass when suddenly a half dozen jeeps pulled up. Lo and behold, in the second jeep was the man himself, in full heavy winter khaki uniform. And here were Fidel Castro's first words. ¿Dónde está Bárbara? Where is Bárbara? How on earth did he know my name? Probably because the Today Show reached Havana and Castro, who was known to stay up all night, must have watched it as his lullaby before going to bed. Here I am, I shouted. Here we all are, I continued, pointing out my colleagues. We've been waiting for days, sir, for you to agree to a press conference with us. Castro spoke very little English, but his translator, a pretty woman named Juanita, expressed our urgency, and Castro, with a big smile, agreed. That night, he held a press conference in Havana at the Palace of the Revolution. His message? Lift the blockade, at least for medicines and food. Treat Cuba with respect. Stop trying to assassinate him. We are neighbors, and in one way or another, we ought to live in peace. And no, he had nothing to do with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Pretty much the same words he would be saying for the next 30 years. When, however, we asked him critical questions concerning freedom of the press or the lack thereof, the imprisonment of dissenters, and his role as a dictator who brooked no opposition, Castro's welcoming demeanor disappeared. It may not have been the most startling press conference, but we were thankful that we hadn't come to Havana in vain, for Castro, although long on words, his speeches often ran for hours, were short on granting interviews, and few journalists had gotten to meet him. Since I had been instrumental in bringing about the press conference, my colleagues were appreciative, and that night we toasted one another over generous daiquiris. Now we could return home to toilet seats. The press conference was okay, but every reporter worth his salt, whatever that means, wanted to secure an exclusive interview with Castro. I thought I had landed one. Just before we left his brother's farm earlier in the day, I had managed a few private minutes with Castro, during which I hurriedly asked if he would do a one-on-one interview with me. He readily agreed and said, sometime during the year. But here's the hitch, and I should have paid more attention. He never said, what year? Actually, it would be quite a few years later, and when I finally did get that interview with Castro, it would not run on NBC. It would instead help to keep me from drowning at ABC. The Million Dollar Baby. It all began with a tennis game in March of 1976 on a private court in Westchester, New York. The players were Lou Weiss, who headed the television department at the William Morris Agency, and his neighbor, Fred Pierce, president of the ABC television network. I don't know who won the game, but I do know that I was part of the score. 5 years, Pierce wrote on a matchbook cover and handed it to Weiss. For $5 million. That's what Fred Pierce was offering to lure me away from NBC to ABC. An offer of $500,000 from ABC's entertainment division to do 4 one-hour specials a year and an additional $500,000 from the news division to co-anchor the ABC Evening News with veteran newsman Harry Reasoner. It was an astonishing and unexpected proposal. The money didn't bowl me over. I was already making close to that amount at NBC. It was the historic offer to become the first female co-anchor of a network news program. A woman doing the network news was unheard of, and certainly not something I had ever considered. The prestigious position had always been a male bastion, and the prevailing thought was that delivering the news about politics, wars, and natural disasters would not be taken seriously if done by a woman. I was tempted by the prospect, but only tempted. It was not in my nature to be courageous, to be the first. I was the same person who chose the so-called lesser sorority in high school rather than take a chance on not being chosen at all. I was the same person who was afraid to remain on the waiting list at Wellesley College, my first choice, and to choose Sarah Lawrence because it was a sure thing. I had had enough drama and ups and downs in my life to want to veer toward the safe, sure side. Safe was NBC and the Today Show. I had always thought I would stay until they no longer wanted me. Then they would give me a gold watch and I would go on to do, well, I wasn't sure what, but that was a long time away. Still, Lou Weiss and Lee Stevens persisted. Why not take a meeting with the ABC folks? What could I lose? It could be interesting to hear their views and might influence what I wanted for my own future at NBC. So Lee arranged a secret meeting for me in a private dining room at ABC's Century City complex in Los Angeles. I was in L.A. for the Academy Awards that March, and the feeling was that a meeting there would not be noticed as much as if it were held in New York. I was flattered that the biggest guns at ABC were present. Leonard Goldenson, the chairman of the board, whom I've already told you I knew slightly, Elton Rule, the president of ABC Incorporated, the aforementioned Fred Pierce, and Bill Sheehan, the president of ABC News. They sweetened the proposal. They promised to expand the half-hour news broadcast to an hour, an unheard-of first on any network. Were I to become the first woman to co-anchor the news, the additional half-hour would give me the opportunity to use my strength. Interviews. Not only would I be delivering the news along with Harry Reasoner, I would also be able to supplement it in a more personal, in-depth way and in prime time, which had never been done before. As appealing and flattering as this was, I still did not take very seriously their proposal, which also included serving once a month as the moderator of ABC's Sunday morning public affairs show, Issues and Answers, and co-anchoring or appearing on special news programming such as election night coverage. I had no desire to leave today. Lee was negotiating my new contract with NBC, and I was sure it would all work out. I certainly wanted it to. I thought NBC wanted it to as well. Why, then, was Lee having such a difficult time? He had started talking to NBC back in December 1975, so everything would be in place by September 1976, when the new contract would take effect. The men he was talking to were Herb Schlosser, the president of NBC, Dick Wald, the president of NBC News, and its chief negotiator, Al Rush, vice president of NBC's program and talent acquisitions. But the men were balking. They couldn't really argue with the money Lee was asking for. William Morris had figured out the gross profits the Today Show and Not For Women Only were making from their 30-second commercial advertisers and calculated what my contribution was worth on those terms. Lee also argued that I was entitled to the same compensation given to the stars of successful network entertainment series, like Johnny Carson, especially since, unlike them, I didn't receive residuals for reruns. The figures Lee proposed were not that meteoric. A gradual annual increase, starting at $800,000 a year for 1976, I was already making $700,000, then an increase of $100,000 a year for the duration of the contract. It was the duration that proved to be the first inflammatory point. Lee and I wanted to extend the 3-year contract to a 5-year contract. I was unmarried. I had a child and my family to support. I didn't know how long all this was going to last, and I wanted and needed some degree of security. But Al Rush would have none of it. "Over my dead body," was his response, Lee told me later. 3 years, that's it. Perhaps Lee, who was well used to the nasty art of negotiating, did me a disservice by reporting this to me. But he did. As a result, for the first time, it began to erode my loyalty toward NBC. It eroded further when Lee and I asked to have some control over what interviews and features I would do on the show, perhaps over who the new producer would be, should there be one, and who, in the future, my co-host might be. As things stood, I had no say in anything. Stuart Schulberg assigned me the pieces I did, and though he was very flexible, there was no guarantee that he would be on the program forever. Furthermore, although I liked Jim Hartz, the program had already had 5 male hosts, and who knew what or whom the future would bring? I couldn't bear the thought of another Frank McGee. The hackles went up again. The very notion that I, as a news person, considered talent and not an executive, would have the right to say what features or interviews I wanted to do, or whom I wanted as a producer or co-host, was totally out of the question. What sort of precedent would that set? I didn't want to make waves, so Lee watered down my request for control to simple participation. Would they agree that I be consulted, that my views would at least be considered in making these selections? That would mean that I had no authority, just the opportunity to suggest. But this, too, caused a furor. Dick Wald and Julian Goodman, the former president of NBC and now the chairman and CEO, were particularly outraged by my request for consultation. I was surprised by Dick's reaction. Years before, we had snuck out of an NBC Christmas party on a clandestine romp to see Deep Throat, a much-talked-about porn film. I liked, trusted, and respected him, and thought he liked, trusted, and respected me. But he obviously didn't. Neither did Julian Goodman, though that didn't surprise me. It had been Goodman, remember, who had backed Frank McGee's edict that I could only come in on the fourth question during a Today interview. This time he evidently wanted me gone altogether. I heard that he didn't like the fact that I had appeared as a guest on a nationally syndicated daytime program hosted by the popular Mike Douglas. I enjoyed being on the show, and I also thought my appearance might bring new viewers to the Today Show. But Goodman didn't see it that way. He disapproved of a member of the news department appearing on such a lighthearted program. To add insult to injury, he had also seen me doing a little soft shoe on the Johnny Carson show during one of my guest host appearances. He hated that. Serious journalists did not do soft shoe or appear on daytime talk shows. I wonder how he would have felt about NBC's news anchor, Brian Williams, last year doing skits on Saturday Night Live. The negotiations were further complicated by the frequent absence of the NBC executives at the table. As not such good luck would have it, the network was in the throes of a huge strike by NABET, National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, the broadcasting and cable TV sector of the Communication Workers of America. The engineers had walked off their jobs, along with the maintenance workers and news writers. The strike was serious, and NBC was preoccupied with training its executives to fill the holes left by the union strikers. Therefore, my contract negotiations were often canceled or given little attention. Who had time to think about Barbara Walters in the midst of the calamity befalling NBC? Far more pressing were the union meetings at which Herb Schlosser, NBC's then president, was spending most of his days. He never once took the time to meet with me. As if that weren't enough, there was turmoil at RCA, NBC's parent company. Robert Sarnoff, RCA's CEO and son of NBC's famous founder, General David Sarnoff, was suddenly fired by the board for no apparent reason. The prevailing story was that Bobby, as he was known, was spending too much time away from work and using the company plane to accompany his new wife, the famous opera soprano Anna Moffo, on her singing engagements. That was bad for Bobby, and bad for me. Bobby liked me, and probably would not have allowed NBC to treat me as cavalierly as they were at the time. I didn't know the incoming CEO, Andy Conrad. I had never met him. As the negotiations continued to drag on, I began to think more seriously about ABC. One advantage, and it was spellbinding to contemplate, was that I wouldn't have to get up anymore at 4:30 a.m. After 13 years of getting up in the dark, I could live a normal life. Jackie and I would be able to have breakfast together. I could walk her to school. I would have much more time with her. And if I went out in the evening, I wouldn't have to worry about being exhausted the next day. A whole new world would open up for me. I was also excited by the expanded news broadcast the ABC executives had promised. There would be ample time for interviews, which were my strength, and would make the broadcast unique. No nightly news anchor did interviews. It would set our broadcast apart from the traditional talking heads and newsreaders. Also, there wouldn't be the continuous volume of daily homework that was swamping me. The articles that had to be read, the films of celebrities I should really see, the books I had to skim by authors due to appear on the program. I think hosting or co-hosting a morning show may be the most difficult as well as the most rewarding program you can do. Anchoring the evening news meant being up to date on all the major developments of the day, but it didn't require nearly as much advance preparation. Other options were even more seductive. You could arrive at the office as late as 3 p.m. if you wanted to, and work with the managing editor on the news for that night. ABC did three feeds, one at 6 p.m., one at 6:30, and another, if there was an update and they had to, at 7. By 7:45, you could be at home. In short, a normal life. But normal or not, after thinking it over, I decided that I was happy, successful, and ensconced at NBC. Why rock the boat? Tell ABC no, I told Lee. ABC, however, wouldn't take no for an answer. The network was determined to beef up its news division, which was a distant third in the ratings to CBS with Walter Cronkite and NBC with John Chancellor. We considered ABC the schlock news network. The joke used to be if you wanted to end the Vietnam War, put it on ABC, and like all their programs, it would end quickly. Hiring the first female co-anchor in broadcast history would, they felt, give the news a needed shot in the arm. It could bring more women viewers, and luring me away from the Today Show might also help Good Morning America gain ground. ABC's other divisions were on the fast track at the time. Fred Silverman, a programming genius, had been wooed away from CBS to head the entertainment division. With such innovative primetime programs as the first big TV miniseries, Irwin Shaw's 12-hour Rich Man, Poor Man, and several popular new shows like Charlie's Angels and Starsky and Hutch, Fred was taking ABC from last place to first in the primetime ratings. That was before 1977, when he brought the all-time winner miniseries Roots to the television screen. The other genius at ABC was Roone Arledge, who had left NBC to revolutionize ABC's sports division. He had certainly moved on since our time together at WNBT in 1953 on the children's show Ask the Camera. By 1976, Roone was well on his way to becoming a sports programming legend. He created ABC's Wide World of Sports and Monday Night Football. He also personally produced the ABC coverage of both the Winter and Summer Olympics and brought his singular, up-close-and-personal touch to the athletes' stories. Between Roone and Fred, ABC's profits were soaring. More than $29 million in 1975, $83 million in 1976, an astonishing $165 million to come the following year. So offering me $1 million a year was no big deal to them. They could well afford it, especially since only half that amount would be borne by their news division, the rest would be paid by ABC's entertainment division. In truth, it was a bargain for ABC. It wouldn't cost the news department much to bring Harry's salary in line with mine, and the four specials could bring in many millions of dollars. But I still planned to stay at NBC. Then, wouldn't you know it, in April, a month after my secret meeting with ABC in Los Angeles, the million-dollar figure was somehow leaked to the press. That offer finally got NBC's attention, but it started a nightmare for me. Overnight, I became the million-dollar news baby, proffered a salary that, on the surface, was at least twice as much as anyone else was making in the news business, including Walter Cronkite. Lost in the barrage of incredulous media reporting was the fact that the ABC offer, which I hadn't accepted, was being split between the news and entertainment divisions. I would, in fact, be making less at ABC News than I was at NBC News, but nobody cared. Except me. With ABC's offer now public, NBC began negotiating in earnest. In fact, they told Lee Stevens he could write his own ticket to keep me there. An agreement was hastily drawn up. The same salary as ABC was offering with, yes, a 5-year contract. A maximum of 2 more years on Today and then perhaps my own specials or a news magazine. Everything except for my right to be consulted in the areas that directly affected my work. Then the new CEO of RCA, Andy Conrad, got into the act. "What's this all about?" he asked Herb Schlosser. "Barbara Walters may go to ABC," Herb answered. "Is it about money?" Conrad asked. "No, we'll pay her the same money," Herb said. "Then what's this all about?" Conrad pressed. "It's about her having the right to be consulted on a new producer, and her right to be consulted on a new co-host, and her right to have input on the pieces she does. Julian and Dick don't think that is a good idea," Herb said. "Hang on to her," Conrad said. "Give her whatever she wants." With those marching orders, Dick Wald wrote a letter to be attached to the NBC agreement, giving me consultation rights, and Herb Schlosser asked me to lunch. There are a lot of things I don't remember about this time, but I remember so clearly him saying these words, "Barbara, don't leave us. We need you." Where had he been all this time? I have never felt so torn, personally and professionally. NBC had stalled so long by then that even with all their adjustments, I already had a taste of what a future at ABC might mean. There was now that real opportunity of having a different, easier kind of life. 13 years of a grueling schedule would come to an end. Not just doing Today 5 days a week, but not for women only as well. I agonized over the next few weeks, going through the pros and cons. I was driving myself crazy. I just couldn't come to a decision. As my weeks of tortuous indecision went on, Lee Stevens was encouraging me to go. "What an event it will be," he proclaimed. "You'll be making broadcast history. You'll be changing the world for other female journalists." That really got to me. This wasn't just about me. The role of women in broadcasting would be vastly improved. Could I help to bring that about? If so, what a genuine accomplishment. But what if I was a huge flop anchoring the news? I would be destroying what it had taken me years to achieve. There was also the question, as yet unanswered, about my potential co-anchor, Harry Reasoner. I'd first met him many years before at the Democratic convention that nominated Lyndon Johnson. We'd had a rather flirtatious lunch. I'd seen him again on the trip to China with Nixon in 1972. Had he been part of the old boys' club in China that stonewalled me? I couldn't remember. I couldn't imagine he'd be happy sharing the anchor job with me, a girl from the Today Show. I couldn't imagine him being happy sharing the anchor job with anyone. He'd come to ABC from CBS, leaving 60 Minutes, specifically to anchor the ABC Evening News. For a while, he'd shared the slot with another veteran newsman, Howard K. Smith, but somehow he'd gotten rid of Smith. And now, me. A woman he probably wouldn't think had news credentials, who had grown up in television and never worked on a newspaper or at a wire service. The early indications were not reassuring. The New York Times reported that Harry had initially threatened to quit when he heard I might be coming to ABC. His attitude had improved only a little bit since. "I'm trying to keep an open mind about it," he told the Times. Another source, however, was quoted as saying Harry thought the ABC offer to me seemed in the nature of a stunt rather than a solid journalistic move. Said Harry to Newsweek, "I was with her on Nixon's China trip, but I never actually saw her work. All I know about her from that trip is that she rides a bus well." Not very encouraging words. Heaven knows why, but it didn't occur to me, or for that matter to anyone else, to arrange a meeting with Harry. That seems insane to me today. Is it possible that with all the turmoil I was too busy? Granted, I was still at NBC, but it certainly would have been helpful to talk to him personally, rather than reading what he'd said in the papers. I didn't know how he really felt, only how ABC executives felt, and the head of ABC News, Bill Sheehan, seemed to me to be a bland, rather ineffectual fellow. I couldn't really rely on his opinion. So there I was, not knowing what to do. Back and forth, forth and back, almost paralyzed by indecision, I somehow managed to get through the Today Show and Not For Women Only every morning. Then I spent most of the rest of the day answering, or more to the point, not answering, the questions from the media about my decision. Newsweek wanted to do another cover story. Time was planning a major piece. Then there was Sander Van Oker, the television critic for The Washington Post, who called me daily for the answer and even wanted an exclusive. I'm not one to hold a grudge, but I found it ironic that Sandy, the former NBC reporter who never shared his slot with me as a pool reporter all those years ago in India with Jackie Kennedy, was now asking me for an exclusive. I talked to him, but I didn't give him one. In truth, I didn't know what to say. Thank heaven for Alan Greenspan. Remember I told you he saw me through an agonizing time? Well, this was it. I hemmed and hawed, paced up and down, wrung my hands. NBC was home. ABC was the unknown. What to do? Alan listened to me patiently night after night while I tried to reach a decision. He was a calm and objective friend. He also did a little homework on his own. He was somewhat concerned that ABC might not be able to come up with the $5 million guaranteed for 5 years. He did some calculations and determined they could. That was reassuring. ABC could pay the money if I could deliver the goods. By then, a media frenzy was building. It may seem strange today that my staying or going would be such a story, but remember the headlines about Katie Couric when she left NBC for CBS 30 years later. Back when I was agonizing about what to do, no woman had ever been considered as anchor or co-anchor on a network news program. Equally important, no news person was making $1 million. There were reporters and photographers staked out in front of my apartment building. We were still living in my rent-controlled apartment on West 57th Street, and there was no doorman to hold them at bay. The reporters were making Jackie very nervous. My indecision had to end. And it did. On Wednesday afternoon, April 21st, in Radio City Music Hall, where I'd taken 7-year-old Jackie to see the musical classic That's Entertainment. I was totally worn out, but I felt that in the past few weeks, I hadn't been spending enough time with her. Why I thought this nostalgic review of Hollywood's past musicals would be her cup of tea, I don't know. But it was a chance for us to hold hands and be together, with no phones ringing and nobody pushing for my attention. Sitting in the darkened theater, still torturing myself, I remembered Richard Nixon saying to me at some point, "Don't make any decisions when you're exhausted." He was right, I knew, and I was indeed exhausted. But I just couldn't go on this way. And somewhere in the midst of watching Fred Astaire, whom I'd interviewed, and Ginger Rogers, whom I'd also interviewed, whirl so elegantly and gracefully on the screen, I decided to go to ABC. Their evening news had nowhere to go but up. I didn't want to spend the next 2 years at NBC getting up at 4:30 a.m. I wanted time to be with my daughter. The expansion of the news to an hour would play to my strength. How could I go wrong? I held my nose and jumped. I called Lee at 9 the next morning after I did my 2 hours on Today to tell him my decision. Lee said he would call Herb Schlosser and Al Rush. Then I had to rush off to tape a whole bunch of shows for Not For Women Only and to tape a few commercials that were to run on Today. That is when it got ugly. When I returned to my office, I planned to call Herb Schlosser to tell him personally I was leaving NBC. But instead, the phones were ringing off the hook with devastating news. A series of anonymous spokesmen from NBC had called every newspaper and news magazine and the wire services to announce that they had withdrawn their counteroffer, knowing full well that I had been the one to end the negotiations. I guess it was to save face before the public announcement that I was going to ABC, but nonetheless, it was very harmful to me then and long term. Citing the carnival atmosphere surrounding the negotiations, NBC put out a series of lies. They claimed that I had demanded a private limousine and a full-time hairdresser and makeup person. How absurd. NBC had been providing these services to me and to many others for years, but it sounded good and greedy. These were things that one would associate with a movie queen, not a journalist, and we had second thoughts, one of the spokesmen told the New York Times. I was furious and called Dick Wald. He claimed he knew nothing about the release, which was also a lie. I found out later he had been at the meeting that morning with Julian Goodman, Herb Schlosser, Al Rush, and the publicity people who would be the actual hatchet men. It was Al Rush, the chief negotiator, who entered the meeting saying, "I think the boat has sailed. I think ABC's got her." Well, it's a long way from "I think" in the morning to "movie queen" by the afternoon. But they had decided then and there in that meeting to publicly withdraw their offer. And guess what? They felt it was my fault. Not only were they angry that I was leaving, But who did I think I was, anyway, that I hadn't called them myself to tell them my decision? No one considered that I was busy doing my job, co-hosting the Today Show and taping back-to-back complete programs of Not For Women Only and the commercials that were so profitable to the network. Herb Schlosser later claimed they had tried several times to reach me by phone, but I was doing the commercials and couldn't be reached. Ridiculous. Is it conceivable that the chairman and CEO of NBC, the president of NBC, the president of NBC News, and the vice president of program talent and acquisitions could not at least have gotten a message to me? We were all in the same building, for goodness sake. Which brings me back to Dick Wald, who stood in my office that afternoon and claimed he had no knowledge of the contract withdrawal and said that he'd take care of it right away. According to my assistant, Mary Hornicle, Dick left my office about 10 minutes before six. Shortly afterward, John Chancellor came on the evening news and announced, NBC valued Barbara's service highly, but the negotiations for a renewal of her contract involved $1 million and other privileges, and this afternoon NBC pulled out of the negotiations, leaving her a clear path to ABC. We wish her luck in her new job. To his credit, John later told me that he was very upset when he found out it wasn't true, and that I had been the one to end the negotiations, but the damage had been done. Our mistake, Lee Stevens's and mine, was not to send out our own release with the news that I was going to ABC. Somehow we thought NBC would be gracious enough to work out a joint release, or at least discuss what should be said. We couldn't have been more wrong. When I left the studio at the end of the day, the flashbulbs practically blinded me. The headlines the next day were horrendous. One paper compared me to a Radio City Rockette, a chorus girl reading the news and wanting to be taken seriously. Then came the drumbeat of the money. The press was relentless on the $1 million baby, or more, the $5 million baby. Even the foreign press picked up the money story. German newspapers, French, Japanese, Indian, on and on. Kobieta za 5 milionów dolarów, ran the headline in a Polish newspaper. I was becoming famous practically all over the world. Small consolation then, although it would be helpful years later, when I wanted to interview world leaders. Then there were my television colleagues. Everyone from Walter Cronkite to the head of CBS News to sportscasters was clucking away about the $1 million death of journalism. Is Barbara a journalist or is she Cher? Asked Richard Sallant, the president of CBS News. Cronkite echoed his boss's views, claiming he had experienced the sickening sensation that we are all going under. But you know what? Almost every television journalist, including Harry Reasoner, walked into his boss's office, demanded a raise, and got it. Well, you're welcome. A few brave voices, especially from women, were raised in my defense. There is in my paranoid little mind a vague suspicion that the controversy wouldn't have raged as far and deep if Ms. Walters had been Mr. Walters, wrote columnist Ellen Goodman in the Washington Post. She was echoed by Marianne Means, a syndicated columnist for Hearst Newspapers, who wrote, The controversy over Barbara Walters' whopping $5 million contract to co-anchor the ABC Nightly News smells to high heaven of sour grapes. The real shocker is not that a co-anchor person has reached the $1 million yearly figure, but that a woman has. A few men also wrote in my support. One of them was Bill Barrett, the television columnist for the Cleveland Press. Barbara Walters deserves the opportunity, he wrote. She's come a long, long way, a lot farther than any man would have had to go to get to the big network news chair. I was even the subject of an editorial in the Charleston Evening Post. Barbara Walters is both a gifted journalist and an accomplished showman. We refuse to say show person. We rejoice with the merest trace of envy at the elevation of a reporter to the upper bracket of stardom. I was grateful for the voices raised in my defense, but I was also uncomfortable being a centerpiece in the gender wars and in the entertainment versus news wars, the purest wars that saw money as the death of journalism. Journalists, I felt, are supposed to report the news, not be the news. I somehow continued to do the Today Show. My contract with NBC had another 4.5 months to run. But I was miserable. It was very tense on the set and in the halls, sort of like staying on in the same apartment with an ex-husband. The reports coming in about Harry Reasoner didn't help. One article quoted a woman at ABC as saying he was a male chauvinist pig. What upset me the most came from Lou Weiss. He had seen Harry in a restaurant shortly after the ABC announcement, and Harry was complaining loudly for all to hear how he didn't want me. Lou was so taken aback by Harry's public outburst that he told me that maybe we had made a mistake. It was a little late for that observation. I wasn't long at NBC. The network took me off the air in June. The nation's bicentennial celebrations were coming up, and they didn't want me broadcasting that major event. But they also didn't let me out of my contract. They would not let me go to ABC or even to set foot in the ABC newsroom until my contract expired in September. If I had, they could have sued me for breach of contract, and in their anger, they just might have. So there was no 2-hour farewell program of Barbara's greatest hits over the last 13 years on Today, or excerpts from the many interviews I had done. It was goodbye and good riddance. On my last day, I was permitted to say a few closing words to the viewers who, by devotedly watching, had so changed my life. This is what I said. The Today Show is 24 years old. During the first 12 years, there were 33 different women on the program. For the past 13 years, there has been only one. In the early years of the program, I was sort of a glorified tea pourer, but times have changed. Women in television no longer have to begin as I did, and I'm happy for whatever small contribution I've made toward this change. And that was that. There was a small party for me with the Today cast and crew in Studio 3K at 9 a.m. Not the best time for a party. The Alpo people had at least given me a lunch the day before and presented me with a magnum of champagne in a red ice bucket shaped like a fire hydrant. The dogs were seemingly more grateful for the dog food commercials I'd done for them than the humans were for the work I'd done at NBC. I didn't get a farewell watch at the going-away party, but that was fine. More valuable to me by far was the silver box I got from the Today producers with an inscription. To Barbara, love Today. Even more gratifying was a gold bracelet with a charm from the program stagehands and crew members with my name on it and the words, "We love you." And it was over, just like that. That night I went to Herb Schlosser's 50th birthday party. I'd been invited before the nasty endgame at NBC. All my friends at NBC were going to be there, including the major players in the failed contract negotiations, Dick Wald and Al Rush. I wanted to see how they would react when I walked in. It was not pleasant. The room went completely silent when I arrived. Everyone froze, like a still frame in a movie. The tableau resonated with the unspoken, "What is she doing here?" Herb rallied through the shock. He alone was a gentleman. "How nice to see you, Barbara," he said, coming up to greet me. I responded, "Well, I wouldn't have missed your birthday, Herb." I smiled, made my manners, and left after 10 painful minutes. As I write this, once again, I can't help but contrast my experience with what happened to Katie Couric when she left NBC. There was little uproar over the salary CBS was giving her, a reported $15 million a year. NBC gave her the most glorious send-off, a 3-hour retrospective preceded by 2 weeks of tributes, messages from celebrities and high-profile politicians, special music written for her, and past clips of her work from her years on Today. There was a gala going away party and an equally warm welcome awaiting her at CBS. It is true that even in 2006 there were articles and editorials about whether Katie would succeed, but nothing scathing or mean when she left NBC, no lies and nothing deliberately hurtful. We did the same kind of send-off for Meredith Vieira when she chose to leave my daytime program on ABC, The View, to take Katie's place on Today. We gave Meredith goodbye tributes, a going-away party for her whole family, and most of all, our loving best wishes. We were sorry she was leaving, but happy about the new chapter in her life. Perhaps my experience was the price of being first, and in a very different time. Back in 1976, you could freely attack a woman for wanting to attempt to do a so-called man's job, especially in the holier-than-thou men-only news departments. Many people still believed that women were supposed to know their place and stay in it. There were few women in front of the camera, and fewer still in any kind of executive position. Today, that same attitude would not only be politically incorrect, but the backlash would be enormous. After I left the Today Show, NBC made the decision not to renew Jim Hartz's contract. Instead, they quickly announced that the new co-hosts of Today were to be newsmen Tom Brokaw and Jane Pauley, a perky young woman from NBC's Chicago affiliate. I sent Jane a congratulatory telegram. "You are beginning a wonderful new life. Get a good alarm clock and enjoy." One thing she wouldn't need from me was any advice on how to handle the dogs in the Alpo commercials because, in another change, the talent on the Today Show was no longer going to be required to do commercials. One more thing about my departure from NBC, the most important of all. I did not know back then what I learned when I began to research that painful period for this book. In 2006, I had lunch with Lou Weiss, he of the famous Matchbook tennis game in 1976, and now the chairman emeritus of William Morris, and with my former NBC colleagues Dick Wald and Herb Schlosser. Both were fired within 2 years of my departure. I have no idea whether it had anything to do with me. Schlosser later went into investment banking. Wald eventually came to ABC News, and we became friends again. Each gave me his view, as best he remembered, of the turmoil surrounding my exit from NBC. They didn't agree on everything, but they did agree on this. If I had stayed at NBC, I never would have had the same opportunities I have had at ABC. NBC's ratings were in a slump. ABC's star was rising fast. And with Dick and Herb gone, there would have been no one who would have been looking out for me or invested in my future. "You needed a place where you could create a brand new career," Herb Schlosser told me. "That would not have happened at NBC." Dick Wald concurred. "You would never have been able to do specials at NBC. They had no plans to do any news magazine shows, and you would certainly not have had a chance in hell of being an anchor or co-anchor on the evening news." Well, what an eye-opener. For 30 years, I had wondered, even agonized at times, if I had made the right decision. The parting was so difficult and distressing. Now, finally, I know that I did not make a mistake. I can't tell you what a relief, even after all this time, it is to know that, even though what followed was so much worse. Don't let the bastards get you down. It was a terrible summer. I was convinced that I had made an awful mistake by leaving NBC. Every day reinforced that opinion. I remember thinking I should go to a psychiatrist so that I would have someone sympathetic to talk to. But there was no point. There was nothing anyone could do for me. A nice, relaxing, nervous breakdown might have helped, but I couldn't afford that. Since NBC was holding me to my contract, I couldn't do any work for ABC. I was put out to pasture for the 3 summer months, and rather than enjoy the luxury, I hated it. It was not that my work was my life. I did and do have friends and interests and, of course, my daughter. But once I left NBC, I was completely cut off from what was professionally familiar, rewarding, and fulfilling. The future looked very bleak. Harry and I finally met with Bill Sheehan over lunch in Los Angeles. I recall feeling as if I were entering an arranged marriage and meeting my fiancé for the first time under the watchful eye of a chaperone. But while some arranged marriages are happy and successful, This one did not look promising. Harry was sardonic and sour, but the die was cast for him as well as for me. For now, neither of us had a way out. We shook hands at the end of the lunch. As I remember, I said something like, "You won't be sorry." Harry smiled a tight little smile, and we went about our day. Poor man, he must have been miserable. But the misery quickly became mine. We were in Los Angeles for a meeting with the ABC affiliates from all over the country. This was an extremely important meeting. One, I was about to be introduced to the owners and general managers of all the local stations carrying ABC's programming, many of whom were betting on ABC News to rise in the ratings and help to lift the rest of their programs. Equally important, I was going to tell my new colleagues just why it was so peachy that ABC News was going to expand from its 30-minute format first to 45 minutes and eventually to an hour. Remember, the longer news was one of the major reasons that I had decided to make the move. Remember, too, that I had been told emphatically by all the top ABC executives that they were committed to the expansion of the broadcast so that I could supplement the news of the day with brief newsmaker interviews. I assumed that Bill Sheehan had already delivered this message to their affiliates, and I was not to be the messenger, but the cheering section. So I was excited before the meeting, and sure that this expanded program would be well received. But as it turned out, no ABC executive had even warned the affiliates of what was coming, let alone endorsed it. Bill Sheehan made a few lame remarks at the meeting about the expanded news show being inevitable and that ABC would like to lead. Harry, too, put in his 2 cents about the expansion, but 2 cents wasn't going to do it. Obviously, he was leaving it to me to make the case. Now I wonder, did the news division know all along that the affiliates would fight this move? Had they offered me the extra time just to get me to sign the contract? To say that the meeting did not go well is to put it mildly. I gave my impassioned speech about the value of being the first network to lengthen the national news and the time it would give me to do headliner interviews. But instead of applause, there was a chilling silence. They were too polite to boo me off the stage, but I felt they wanted to. Harry, on the other hand, took the podium to thunderous applause. The adoration continued during his off-the-cuff remarks. "We won't be cutesy, we won't be catty," Harry informed the doting audience. "And if we don't like each other, nobody out there will know it." "Harry, you'll get to like me," I quickly interjected. That at least got a laugh from the affiliates, but it was obvious where their affection lay. Because of my strong support for expanding the news, I wasn't ABC's newest star. I was ABC's million-dollar disaster. And so died the dream of the hour-long news broadcast I'd been promised, and with it, my hope of presenting regular interviews that would set us apart from the other news broadcasts. By the way, the hour-long news program still hasn't happened. The local affiliates then and now have no intention of giving up 1 second of their lucrative local newscasts. One blow followed another during that desultory summer. At some point after we returned to New York, I went over to ABC News on 66th Street and Columbus Avenue to see where I would be working in the fall. I didn't dare go inside because of the NBC directive that I not set foot in an ABC newsroom while I was still under contract. Looking at the outside of the place was just as disheartening. I found a small, ordinary-looking building in the middle of a bunch of West Side apartment houses. Years later, ABC would build a huge complex, but now there was just this small building with, from what I could see through the revolving door, only a single elevator. How could I have left one of the world's greatest news divisions and my sunny office overlooking the famous skating rink at Rockefeller Center and at Christmas time the giant tree to come to this third-rate nothing building? I walked by the place a few times, then left quickly for fear of being seen. I felt even more lost as the summer continued. The bicentennial celebrations were in full swing all over the country without me. My last broadcast on the Today Show had included a taped piece I'd done on the bicentennial in my home state of Massachusetts. But after that, because I wasn't allowed to work, nothing. Over the 4th of July weekend, there was a parade in New York Harbor of hundreds of 19th century tall ships from all over the world. I would have loved to have covered it, but instead, as I got dressed in the morning, I watched Tom Brokaw and Jane Pauley describe the celebration. Later, as the guest of Alan Greenspan, I went to the ship where the ceremonies were taking place. My sometime date, John Warner, as head of the Bicentennial Committee, officiated. I tried to have a good time and forced a lot of smiles, but my heart was heavy. That summer, the presidential conventions were also being held. The Democratic Convention, which nominated Jimmy Carter, began in New York a week after the Bicentennial celebration. The Republican Convention, which nominated incumbent Gerald Ford, took place in August in Kansas City, Missouri. ABC thought I should attend. After all, I would be reporting on election night, but I had no official position. I had worked at every convention since 1964, and there I was, 12 years later, wandering around with no real purpose and no place to go. One night, feeling so outside things, I ventured into the NBC control room and saw many of my old friends. I felt such a pang. They were pleasant and polite, but they were also very busy, so I wandered back out into no man's land. I went into the ABC control room. I knew no one there, and they, too, were busy. It was not a time for introductions or pleasantries. I wandered off again. Between conventions, Bill Sheehan offered to set up a tour of ABC's bureaus for me and meetings with the correspondents. If I wanted, he said, I could go to a few of their European bureaus. But after I talked to a couple of their correspondents in Washington, the trip didn't have much appeal. The Washington correspondents were totally disgruntled. Bill Sheehan had no power, they told me. ABC News was disorganized and cheap. The cameras were old and outdated. There was no money. They had no suggestions for me other than that ABC should start spending some money on better equipment. I wondered if they resented my getting paid so much when that money could have purchased newer cameras. After I heard their complaints, there seemed no point in going to the London Bureau or the Paris Bureau to hear more of how awful everything was. So I repaired for a few weeks to a summer house I'd rented in West Hampton Beach on Long Island. Jackie was going to a little day camp, and I picked her up every day and took her for ice cream. I smiled for Jackie. I was cheerful for Jackie. But it was an act. My malaise was not helped by our summer neighbor, Howard Cosell. Howard was a very well-known ABC sportscaster, but a melancholy and somewhat bitter man. For some reason, he took to visiting me almost daily to complain. ABC didn't appreciate him. ABC certainly wouldn't appreciate me. Harry Reasoner paid no attention to him and wouldn't to me. I finally had to ask Howard to please not tell me any more. The comedian Gilda Radner chose that summer to present her caricature of me, Baba Wawa, on Saturday Night Live. Audiences found her mimicry of my pronunciation of L and R as W hysterically funny. I found it extremely upsetting. I was feeling so down that I probably wouldn't have found anything funny, but everyone else loved Gilda's impersonation. "Hello, this is Bawa Wawa, here to say farewell," Gilda said one Saturday night. "This is my last moment on NBC, and I want to remind you to work for me along with Howie Wiesner weeknights at 7 o'clock. I want to take this opportunity to apologize to NBC," she continued. "I don't like weaving. Please trust me, it's not sour grapes, but rather that another network recognizes in me a great talent for delivering relevant news stories with crystal clarity to millions of Americans. It's the only reason I'm weaving." By the way, I never had trouble with my L's, only my R's, but it made it funnier. People started calling me Baba Wawa behind my back, and even to my face. Sometimes they still do. But because I was so depressed at the time, I felt they were laughing at me rather than laughing at Gilda's characterization of me. My daughter Jackie set me straight. I was walking by her room one Saturday night when I heard her laughing. "Watch this," she said. I watched. Gilda was doing Baba Wawa, and my young daughter thought it was really funny. I mumbled something about not thinking it was so clever, and Jackie said to me, "Oh, Mom, lighten up." Hearing that from Jackie made me realize that I was losing all perspective. Where was my sense of humor? So I was pleased when I ran into Gilda sometime later in New York at an exhibition at the Canadian Mission to the United Nations. She must have been nervous when she saw me walking toward her. "I guess you know who I am," I said to her, pronouncing my words very carefully and leaving out any R's. She nodded and waited. "Well, do me a favor," I said. "Do me. Please go ahead and do me." We went into a corner and she sat down and became Barbara Walters. She sat the way I sit, with one ankle tucked behind the other, leaned forward just as I do when I'm interviewing someone, and then she started talking. It was right on. She was brilliant, and I told her so. She told me that she and I had the same makeup artist, Bobby Armstrong, who had told her how I sit. Gilda also told me she had studied my way of speaking by watching tapes of Not for Women Only. We parted friends, and I, along with most of America, was truly sad when she died of ovarian cancer in 1989 at the age of 42. I sent a note to her husband, Gene Wilder, which said simply, "She made me laugh. I will miss her. Baba Wawa." There sure wasn't much else to laugh about during my summer in limbo. The negative stories about me continued unabated, and Harry's attitude toward me began to harden. The not-so-subtle implication in the media was that I had been brought in by ABC to save his job. That put him in a lose-lose position. If the ratings improved, it would be seen as evidence that he needed my help. If they went down, we would both be considered failures. The countdown began for our debut in early October. We rehearsed for 2 weeks as soon as my NBC contract expired in September, during which time Harry was civil but hardly friendly. The biggest challenge for me was being handed late-breaking news that had to be instantly incorporated into the broadcast while other stories were just as instantly killed. This was by far my toughest audition, and the pressure was intense. ABC had invested a lot of money in the new broadcast. The set was new. The executive producer was new. The writers were new. Additional correspondents were being hired, several of them, I was happy to see, women. All in all, the national news budget had been boosted by 25%. The broadcast was being promoted and advertised in major newspapers all over the country. The picture of me was ghastly. There was Harry looking straight into the camera, as any anchorman would, and there was I, looking off into the distance with big, wide eyes like some sort of starlet, hardly the image of a co-anchor. The program was called ABC Evening News with Harry Reasoner and Barbara Walters. It didn't occur to anyone, including me, to have my name before Harry's. In fact, my name would always be second to a male partner's. For the 15 years Hugh and I co-hosted 2020, the sequence would always be Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters. But some people considered that an advantage. Years later, when I was interviewing Bing Crosby for one of my specials, he told me that he always asked for second billing whenever he could, and never wanted his name above the title of a movie. That way, he said, if the film was a success, everyone would realize it was, in great part, because of him. But if the film failed, it would not be regarded as his failure. I thought that was very smart. Remember this the next time you see an old Bing Crosby film on television. No matter who got top billing, Harry and I were being promoted as television's most dynamic and informative news team, which was pretty dramatic, if nerve-wracking. I felt my career was on the line. "If the show doesn't make it, I'm finished," I told Newsweek the week before the broadcast began. "But if it does make it, my God, how fantastic." Our first broadcast was scheduled for Monday, October 4th. What I hadn't realized until it was too late was that October 4th that year fell on the holiest of Jewish holidays, Yom Kippur. Most Jewish people do not work that day. They fast until sundown, then usually go to temple, and afterward break the fast with a big dinner. Even though my family did not celebrate the holiday, We never went to temple or fasted. Out of respect for my religion, I never went on the air on that holiday. I still don't. I was bothered that the Jewish people in our audience would know that I had, indeed, been working during the day when no Jew was supposed to work. I really did wonder if God would forgive me, but there was little I could do about it. October was already late to be starting with a new program, but we hadn't been able to begin until my NBC contract had expired, and ABC did not want to wait any longer. My career hung in the balance. After all the hype and press about my move to ABC, millions of people all over the country would be watching to see if I succeeded or fell on my face. On a much smaller scale, the top ABC executives would be watching in an adjacent studio. Their reputations, too, were on the line. I had taped two major interviews by satellite earlier in the day for the first broadcasts. One with Golda Meir, the former Prime Minister of Israel, the other with Anwar Sadat, the President of Egypt. I was happy to be getting interviews with the two world leaders and thought they would be the perfect way to show viewers what I had to contribute to the program. Each interview to run on successive nights was newsworthy. Golda Meir, because the debut of the program coincided with the third anniversary of the 1973 war. Then it was Israelis against Arabs. I wanted Anwar Sadat because now it was Christians against Muslims in a bloody civil war in Lebanon. He would give his insights into the latest threat to peace in the Middle East. At the last minute, however, the interviews threatened the peace at ABC. I had promised Golda Meir that her interview would appear on our first broadcast so that she could give a special Yom Kippur greeting. She also wanted to appear on the program the day before Israel's enemy, Anwar Sadat. But after Bill Sheehan viewed both interviews, he decided that Sadat's interview would run first. I told him about my promise to Golda Meir and argued vehemently against the change, but he was adamant, and as this was my first broadcast, I had to go by his decision. Predictably, Golda Meir was furious when she was informed of the change. She said she would never do another interview with me, and she never did.